Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for today is Costello versus Grundin.
First case for today is Heff.
Mr. Hare.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Harris, and together with James Filio, Gregory Stelzer, and our co-counsel at Davis McGrath, we represent the defendants' appellants in this matter. We seek reversal of judgments that were entered in the trial court after the trial court granted summary judgment against our clients. In the trial court, the movant, who is the appellee here, did not satisfy its burden of production with respect to its motion for summary judgment. We set forth in our briefs numerous issues on which the movant failed to sustain its burden of production. Most of those relate to the Celotex standard, but some of them relate to the Attaque standard. The problems that were presented by the trustee not sustaining its burden of production were compounded when the movant then in its reply brief raised numerous new issues. And we were under no obligation to respond to the issues on which the movant did not sustain its burden of production.
Didn't you get a pretty fair response in your motion to strike, though? That was a pretty exhaustive document, wasn't it?
Well, the motion to strike itself was presented, it was presented with a motion and a supporting brief, but the trial court compounded the errors that had already occurred by adopting certain motions or certain arguments that had been raised for the first time in reply. And also by denying the motion to strike as moot when the trial court granted the motions for summary judgment. It wasn't a situation where the trial court said, I've considered your motion and I'm denying it. And it wasn't a situation where the trial court said, I'm going to allow you to file a surreply.
Well, if we could talk about that for just a minute, I'd be appreciative, because you seem to have made a strategic choice to file a motion to strike rather than a request for a surreply. What I'd like to hear is why you shouldn't be held to that choice, because here's my worry. To rule in your favor could mean that parties would file a motion to strike, and then when they lose, they get a second bite at the apple by claiming they had no chance to reply. And I just don't know what kind of a precedent that would set.
Well, legally, there's no obligation to move for leave to file a surreply. We did when we framed the motion to strike in our request for relief. We did ask for such other relief as the court may direct. But instead of either granting or denying the motion, what the court did instead was simply deny it as moot, which from our perspective was not an exercise of discretion at all. And I think the law is clear that to address your issue with respect to precedent, the law is clear that you're not under an obligation to file a surreply. You can file a motion to strike, and that's an appropriate way of proceeding. It is subject to an abuse of discretion standard in terms of review, but in this particular case, we submit that standard has been met because the trial court simply did not exercise its discretion, but instead denied the motion as moot, while at the same time adopting some of the very arguments that were part of the motion to strike.
But didn't your motion to strike really challenge those arguments? Didn't you, in effect, make the strategic choice that was really a reply in the disguise of a motion to strike?
No, I don't think that's what we did. That certainly wasn't the intent. We obviously had to frame the issue so that the court would understand the context in which we were raising the motion to strike. But the motion to strike was not intended to evade labeling it as a SIR reply.
Do you regret not asking for a SIR reply?
I don't regret not asking for it. If there's a regret, perhaps the regret would be that in our prayer for alternate relief in the motion to strike, we didn't mention the phrase SIR reply. In that context, there's only a couple of things that the court can do in a proper sense. But here what the court did was actually, deny the motion to strike as moot. And to address Your Honor's question, to the extent that we framed out the issues in the motion to strike, we certainly didn't frame them out and discuss them in the way that we would have if we had either moved for leave to file a SIR reply or been granted leave to file a SIR reply.
My difficulty with it is it's pretty clear this is sort of a scorched earth policy on both sides fighting this, and that few stones were left unturned, and that at that stage in the litigation it looks like your focus was in a certain way as opposed to the other. It's not a novel idea to you, I'm sure, to seek leave to file a SIR reply or perhaps for additional discovery if needed in response to new things presented. So this seems really like a choice that was made.
Well, you're correct. Moving for leave to file a SIR reply is an option that was available to us. However, we were under no obligation to pursue such a motion, and moving to strike has been recognized by numerous cases as being the proper way to proceed in that setting.
I'm going to take you a little somewhere else.
Sure.
What is your best evidence that the lenders knew that the loans would violate regulations G or U? Now, set aside for a moment whether the loans actually violated those regulations, and let's focus on the lender's knowledge and intent.
When you look at the way that this transaction was structured, the documentation is very careful to not disclose that there's any violation of Regulation G or Regulation U, and to the contrary, the documents are replete with evidence that there has been compliance with the securities laws, including Regulation G and U. The bank here tried to create a disclaimer in the facility agreement to make it appear that even though there were repeated references in the facility agreement to collateral securing the stock, that those references, after they were repeatedly made, were then disclaimed by saying, hey, even though this phrase is repeatedly used in this document, in essence, it's not true. And we know that subsequent to this transaction actually being implemented, when there were problems with Comdisco stock, that the bank came back out, made a new presentation to Comdisco to revise this plan, and in that new presentation made a very telling statement, which was that between February of 1998 and 1 year later, that Regulation U had changed. And the bank said, and I quote, "The company and the bank can no longer be directly or indirectly secured by the stock. Companies now execute reimbursement agreements with their managers to provide for reimbursement of any amounts paid by the company under the ESP loan guarantee." In reality, and we got into this, and it's for a record site, we presented the fact that, yes, the law had changed during that one-year period in the sense that there had been a merger of Regulation G into Regulation U. And at Haller at R218, the final page, we show where the various regs were merged into new regs. But the reality is there was no change in the law as it related to this particular issue. And the fact that the bank was saying that a year later when it wasn't true says to us that the bank knew, or so an inference could be drawn, that the bank knew back in 1998 that the SIP program, in the sense of these loans, violated Regulation G and Regulation U.
Well, if the panel believes that regulations G and U can be used as affirmative defenses, then there are probably fact questions that would preclude summary judgment. Now, the main one, I take it, you believe, would be whether the stock indirectly secured the bank's loans on the Comdisco guarantee. Am I on the right track as far as you're concerned?
Well, that would be one of the issues, and there's a good faith non-reliance provision built into the regs that is a factually intensive inquiry that would also be a major fact issue.
I hope Mr. Young will maybe help me with this as well, because that seems, you know, that would be a close issue, because we have a bank lending considerable amounts of money to people who have zero or very small net worth. Of course, the bank has Comdisco's guarantee. But Comdisco could go, and did go, bankrupt. And then the bank would have nothing but the defendant's personal assets, which
at the time the transaction was structured, it was a situation where, first of all, under the law, Comdisco was making an extension of credit through the guarantee, which was something that Lola Hale did not even reference in her letter to the Federal Reserve Bank. But from the context of the bank. The bank not only extended credit through the loan, and it, as you said, Your Honor, it's undisputed here that it was in violation of the 50% requirement, but the bank also arranged for ComDisco's extension of credit. The record is replete with evidence that, you know, the bank presented itself as the expert with respect to these kinds of programs. The bank had some prior experience with them. ComDisco elected to work with the bank because of its expertise, and the bank is the one that arranged for ComDisco's extension of credit. So, you know, there's an extension of credit by each, one being a violation of G, one being a violation of U. There's then the bank arranging for ComDisco's extension of credit, which is a separate violation. And then there's a violation with respect to the purpose clause, in that the forms that ComDisco and the bank were obligated to provide our clients were not provided to them. And if they had seen those forms would have said in bold black letters, you know, you can't borrow more than 50%. You know, you can't borrow more than 50%. They never saw that. They never saw that. That was withheld from them. So everything about this transaction, both in terms of what was stated in writing and what was stated during the presentation of the transaction, led them to believe that this transaction was legal. And the evidence is undisputed that if they had been told that it was illegal, nobody would have participated in it.
So the untrue material statement of fact that the lenders made in connection with the loans would be the 50% bar. Is that what you're saying?
That's
absolute. I'm looking for bottom lines here.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one of them. Yes, that's certainly one of them.
Did any misrepresentations affect or relate to the value of the stock?
Well, as we got into in our brief. But not in a major way. As the court is aware, the purchase price, so to speak, was the closing market price on the day that the program was announced, $34.50 a share. There was no disclosure made as to whether the restrictions on the stock would have an adverse impact on the price of the stock. So to that extent, there was a non-disclosure with respect to that issue. However, I know that the trustee here cites to what I think is the Gurwala, I may not be pronouncing that right, decision. But that case, and we pointed it out in our brief, that case has been disavowed by several other cases that we cite in our briefs. So, you know, it was I think I know what happened here, sort of as a practical matter. Obviously, Judge Gettleman had before him numerous cases that had been reassigned to him on the basis of relatedness, and he had, you know, granted motion for summary judgment with respect to two of those cases. And when it became apparent that there wasn't going to be some sort of easy resolution of the remaining cases, and when it became apparent to the trustee that myself and other lawyers were going to enter our appearances in these cases. The trustee reacted very aggressively. Within a few days after we'd filed our appearance, he filed motions for summary judgment. And there's no doubt in my mind he was trying to send a message to us, and he did a very effective job of doing that. But we moved for leave to amend the affirmative defenses and counterclaims within a few days after that. And the trustee ultimately did not object to that. The trustee ultimately filed a supplemental brief that was intended to address those changes specifically, which, by the way, was, I think, the fifth brief that the trustee had actually filed in connection with his motions for summary judgment, because he incorporated by reference all of his other ones. But the bottom line is that, from our perspective, the trustee ran before he looked here after we got involved in the case and after we amended our affirmative defenses. And from the court's perspective, and I don't fault him for this, but I think the court did it wrong because I believe that the court erred in granting the motions for summary judgment.
You know, unless I missed it, I don't think you really responded to the trustee's argument that regulations G and U were not intended to protect individual investors. Can you address that now, or perhaps you did address it during the state? There's a lot here.
I see that the white light is on and that I'm into my rebuttal time. I can either come back to that and rebuttal, because I'm sure he's going to make that point.
Whichever you prefer.
I think I'll do that. Think I'll do that. I did reserve time. Thank you.
Mr. Young.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. This appeal presents the question whether the borrower appellants can use Section 29B of the 1934 Act and their arguments under Reg G, Reg U, and Rule 10b-5 to effectively rescind their obligations under their promissory notes. Judge Gettleman concluded, based on a very full summary judgment record, that they could not, and entered judgment on those notes. We ask this morning that those judgments be affirmed. Now, if I could perhaps start with Judge Rovner's question about the consequences of Reg G and Reg U being accepted as affirmative defenses. I think your specific question to Mr. Harris was whether or not there would be fact issues to resolve, and certainly we agree that if our threshold legal arguments don't carry the day and you let him assert that affirmative defense, we certainly don't concede the Reg G and Reg U violation, and did raise good faith non-reliance in the proceeding below. But we make a more fundamental and more threshold argument that these cases don't need to reach that point, and that Judge Gettleman properly concluded as a matter of law that the remarkable remedy of avoiding the obligations should not be available here.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said, the last. The remarkable remedy of weighing?
The remarkable remedy of rescinding or avoiding or eliminating the note obligations should not be available here. And I just want to touch briefly on the burden of production issues that the panel addressed with Mr. Harris. We, of course, believe that we did satisfy the burden of initial production. And I think the starting point for that analysis is the summary judgment record in the proceeding below itself. It was substantial, and it consisted of not only the transaction documents to which Mr. Harris refers, but also to the comprehensive disclosures of the program that were made to the borrowers. There was a binder, and it's referred to in the briefs and in the appendices, that explained the nature of the program, provided some analysis as to some of the different economic consequences, provided some information as to what the break-even point would be. This was, in short, an extremely comprehensively disclosed program. And as a result of that, Judge Gettleman had a very full record on which to base his analysis. Now, some of the disagreement we have with our opponents really goes to how we read the Dickey and Celotex decisions. They seem to take the point of view that they could look to see whether we had negated every element of their 10b-5, Reg G, and Reg U cases and theories, and unless we had completely negated them, there was no burden on their part of going forward. Regardless of whether a Dickey stands for that proposition, we don't think it does. That's a case in which the summary judgment evidence before the court was sufficient to defeat summary judgment. We think that rule has been refined by the Supreme Court in the Celotex case, and that the current state of the law is that under the plain language of Rule 56, summary judgment is proper where the non-moving party fails to establish the existence of an element essential to its case and on which that party will bear the burden of proof at trial. In short, we were not obliged to negate their claim through every piece of evidence that would do so. We merely had to point to the pieces of the record and offer the substantive evidence necessary to shift the burden to them to come into court and make their case. We did that. They did not.
I'll finish your thought.
I was done.
You see, the bank here seems to have made some very significant loans to people who had little or even net zero, zero net worth. And it just seems like a fantasy to assume that the loans weren't indirectly secured by those shares of stock. Why would the bank give such large loans to people from whom it could not collect unless there was something backing up those loans? Why?
I think the answer, Your Honor, was something you touched on in the earlier questioning of Mr. Harris. It was the guarantee. Now, I might quibble. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
No.
I do take a different point of view on the characterization that these were a series of substantial loans to a group of assetless borrowers. I think the record below reflects there was a variety of circumstances with some people having more substantial assets than others.
But it certainly suggests that wasn't an issue in the lending decision, that there was no real evaluation of the net worth on really any of the loans.
It's a fair statement, Your Honor, that was not a substantial process. Our argument goes a slightly different direction, if I may. Our argument looks to the structure of the program and the fact that I don't think there's any dispute these were not directly secured transactions. No one is contending there was a lien or a hypothecation. The issue is over whether they were indirectly secured. And, in the addendum of legislative materials that our opponents submitted to the court. There's actually some loose leaf digest or binder interpretation of that indirect security question. Lots of decisions going back and forth. But what I think was different about this program was the party extending the loans, the party whose diligence you're focused on, Your Honor, the bank, was not the party that had locked up the stock. What they've essentially alleged is that Comdisco somehow had some control over the stock. And that doesn't equate to the bank tying it up. Now, our further argument is that, in any event, there were not the kind of definitive control agreements or specific restrictions on the stock itself that would bring Reg G and Reg U into play, because the panel will see that in order for any of these theories to work, they've got to show that the stock itself was directly or indirectly secured. That's a threshold precondition for all of this. And to the extent that showing is absent, the entire regulatory argument fails. And really the only thing in the record we can find where they speak to this beyond the structure of the documents themselves is the affidavit of Mr. Scott Harvey, who, while not a defendant in these cases, is subject to a parallel state court action the trustee has brought. And Mr. Harvey's contention is that the stock was held in an investor, in an account that Comdisco had some control over. Well, first of all, we don't think that substantiates the kind of actual control agreement that would amount to indirect security. And in any event, it doesn't tie to the bank. So, Judge Rovner, to come back to the ultimate question, yes, these were substantial loans. Yes, they were, based more on the guarantee than on a comprehensive net worth analysis of each borrower, although some analysis was done. But the ultimate argument we make is you don't need to reach those fact questions because we believe the law, both in the Supreme Court and in this circuit, is that even if you assume a violation of Reg G and Reg U, that does not equate to voiding the notes. And that's the extra step here that I really want to highlight and underline. They are contending that based on this violation, their obligations under these notes are eliminated. And I think there's a couple of important kind of larger policy issues that need to be addressed with that position. This was a program where the borrowers were permitted to buy, given an opportunity to buy a block of common stock. Shortly after the transaction, the stock split, the stock went up, and the summary judgment evidence reflects that 10 of the program participants were able to sell, retire their loans, and realize a profit. So there was an upward movement in the market, and participants made money. The danger of the position that Mr. Harris is advocating is that it creates an opportunity to see how the market goes. And you participate in a program under these circumstances, and if the stock goes up, great, you realize the profit, and if the stock goes down, then you have the Reg G or Reg U argument available.
You know, you made the argument in the briefs that, the windfall argument. And I have to confess that I have difficulty seeing the windfall here. And Comdisco raised a large infusion of capital on the backs of its employees. It was a terrible gamble, and the employees lost. Comdisco settled with the lender and essentially had to give back most of that capital. The money went into the company. The money came out of the company. How is it a windfall to the defendants if they're not required to cover that payout? They never got anything of real value. I know you make that argument that, you know, like 10 people cashed out and came out ahead. Lucky them, smart them, whatever. But what would have happened if everyone had tried to cash out at that point? And don't we have to look at it that way? Not at, you know, not at the 10 who, you know, were prescient.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we respectfully disagree with that particular characterization. We think this was a program that essentially permitted employees, senior managers, to purchase stock in the company. The money that went into the company was the purchase price of the stock. And what this program did was facilitate the credit based on Comdisco's guarantee to allow that to happen. Now, this was a publicly traded company with billions of dollars in assets. And to answer your question, if everybody had tried to cash out 6 months into this thing or after the stock split, I mean, there's no summary judgment evidence, so I can only speculate. But it seems to me that a public company with freely tradable stock, I can't imagine a reason why they wouldn't have been permitted to do so. And indeed, the terms of this SIP program permitted sale of the stock at any time after the first year. I should amend my prior answer to say there was a one-year restriction on selling the stock. But Your Honor, if I can maybe address your bigger philosophical concern, there is a consistent thread in the case law, and it really, I'd like to take it even back prior to the windfall question. There is a doctrine of what I'll call effects of illegality that has been developed in the Supreme Court and in this court. And I think it's very applicable and helpful here. And we dated back, there are older cases, but we dated back to a Supreme Court decision called Kelly versus Kasuga, 1959. It involved an unlawful agreement to corner the onion market, if you can believe such a thing, and the participants in this unlawful conspiracy then went to a bunch of onion purchasers and said, buy our onions or we're going to dump everything in the warehouse onto the market and it will depress the price. And they, you know, consummated a number of sales, and one of those sales resulted in an unpaid purchase price, and the participant in the unlawful conspiracy sued to enforce the purchase price. And the Supreme Court held that that action for the purchase price was enforceable. And the reason was that there was a distinction to be drawn between the unlawful conspiracy or agreement in violation of the antitrust laws and a legitimate agreement for the purchase and sale of goods. And we think that that analysis finds additional expression in this court's decision in Northern Indiana Public Service Company versus Carbon County Coal Company. That's a 1986 decision, and what happened there was a utility had locked into a long-term electrical supply contract that proved disadvantageous. Yes. Thank you. Coal to make electricity. You're absolutely right. And the utility wasn't able to pass on the resulting rate charge when the prices went up. So they defended on a violation of the Mineral Lands Leasing Act. And they raised what I think the record in that case reflected was a established violation, but a relatively minor violation. And what the court did, and I think it followed on the Kelly versus Kasuga analysis, is it first looked at the question of, is the contract inherently illegal? Is this something like a contract to enforce a gambling debt, which is one of the cases our opponents cite? And if it's not an inherently tainted contract, there is a presumption, both under this court's precedents and the Supreme Court authorities, that it should be enforceable. You know, the Kaiser Steel case on which our opponents rely, which addressed enforcement of a so-called hot cargo clause under a collective bargaining agreement, would fall on the inherently illegal side of the line. The second part of the analysis, after you look at is the contract inherently illegal, is what are the relative benefits and burdens of enforcement? And again, if I may, I'll come back to your sort of larger philosophical question, Judge Rovner. The benefit here is that in this circuit, there has always been a focus on protection and enforceability of viable contractual expectations. And this is a case where money was borrowed and stock was purchased, and after the fact, there's an attempt to avoid the loan that purchased the stock. Now, I think everybody agrees what happened in the market and, you know, the resulting status quo is both unfortunate and sympathetic. But at the same time, this was a situation where when the program was implemented, it was not, and I think the summary judgment evidence reflects this, it was not a financing for ComDisco. It was an employee program in which stock in ComDisco was purchased.
You know, I understand that it was the defendants who apparently introduced the McCauley letter into the record. But the district court really does seem to have given it more importance than it was due. What's the effect on your arguments if the McCauley letter isn't due any deference?
If the McCauley letter is not entitled to any deference, our argument continues to be that the structure of the program, the separation between the lender and the stock, the existence of the guarantee, and the absence of a control agreement all amount to a lack of indirect security. You know, putting aside the question of whether the McCauley letter is entitled to deference, we think McCauley was right. And while our opponents, I think, give the college try to try to show McCauley was somehow misled or given an incomplete record, the fact remains that when Lola Hale wrote to him to present the hypothetical, one of the facts she presented was that the stock would effectively be held to the side until the debt was paid. So Judge Gettleman, in his opinion and his analysis, said, hey, even if you didn't disclose every restriction, you disclosed the most important one. And our best guess as to how this conclusion was reached is that Mr. McCauley looked to the separation between the stock over here, which, by the way, was in uncertificated form in accounts in the names of each of the participants, and he looked at the loan over there, and he looked at the absence of any control agreement or pledge document, and that's how he reached the conclusion.
Well, you know, I mean, the judge seemed to think that it was an agency letter entitled to Chevron-like deference when Mr. McCauley was the staff attorney at the Federal Reserve Board of Chicago, which isn't a government agency. And the judge seemed to assume that he was obliged to defer to that letter. And maybe you've answered the question, but
did you want?
Well, you feel that the error doesn't matter much.
Well, do you?
Because even if the SIP violated the regulations, you don't think the regulations were meant to protect borrowers. That's your bottom line.
It's one of a couple. But did you want me to address the standard of review, or?
No, because I am quite certain that he was wrong. So.
Well, Your Honor, we hear you. We don't contend today, by the way, that it's entitled to Chevron deference. And
did you below?
I believe we cited a case called Ford Motor Company versus Mulholland.
So now you change your mind.
Well, Your Honor, I think what I would say is I think both parties really didn't drill down in the proceeding below as to the distinction between the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Again, this was a piece of evidence that came up for the first time in the response to the summary judgment papers.
But it seemed vital to what Judge Gettleman wrote, where he says that he would have, if he were writing on a clean slate, he might agree on the indirect security concept, but he couldn't because of the Macaulay letter.
Well, two answers.
Seems pretty pivotal to how he got
there. There's no doubt, Judge Tinder, that he said that, and the opinion so provides. Two responses. The first is that, and I do take issue with my opponents here, Judge Gettleman spent a lot of time with this case. He was very thorough. He read everything. We certainly disagree that he didn't look at the new evidence or, as you suggested, Judge Tinder, look at the motion to strike and the response as an additional round of briefing. And as we pointed out in the briefs, the letter did say on the head of it, Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. So, we think he took a careful look at this. Now, as to what level of deference he provided it, the opinion doesn't provide a whole lot of additional explanation as to the path there.
I couldn't disagree with you more on that. He assumed that he was absolutely obliged to defer to that letter.
Well, Your Honor, I understand that he did say the comment about the blank slate, so we certainly don't disagree with that. In any event, the second point to Judge Tinder is, again, maybe it's a moot point to the extent that we're certainly not contending here. The panel can't and shouldn't take its own look at the applicability of the regulation. In terms of our bottom line, as you were inquiring, Judge Rovner, A, it's the doctrine of illegality, and I haven't mentioned it, but Section 29C of the 1934 Act also contemplates that even with a voidable contract under Section 29B, loans can be treated differently. And 29C contemplates that where you've got a lender who doesn't have actual knowledge of the illegality, there's a safe harbor for the loan.
Say that again.
29C of the 1934 Act contains a safe harbor for lenders such that a violation that would otherwise be voidable under 29B is protected under 29C to the extent it's a lender without what I'll call actual knowledge of illegality. And that goes to the question you
asked. Even when you have the most sophisticated lender that ever lived?
Your Honor, I think the standard is knowledge. And I think your question to Mr. Harris was an invitation You invited him. Give me your best evidence they knew it was illegal. And I took careful notes, and I heard him, and you know, essentially what he pointed you to was a presentation a year later that may or may not have involved the same people, and the structure of the transaction where he points to the disclaimer is saying, hey, they must have known. That evidence isn't in the record. The other leg of the stool is we rely on this court's prior decision in the Bassler case, district court decision Blair versus Bank One, which involved this very same program, for the proposition that there's also a lack of what you'd call statutory standing here. It coincides, by the way, with the zone of interest test under the illegality doctrine. This is just not a class of claimants who were intended to be benefited by this statute. And there are some very practical reasons why the zone of interest test keeps recurring in all of these issues we're talking about. It comes up in standing. It comes up in effects of illegality. It even comes up in those excuse for non-performance cases that are at the end of each of the briefs, and a case this court decided called ADM versus Collins that involved a commodities contract and a violation of margin rules offered as a defense to an obligation on an account. The reason this rule makes sense is because it prevents the anomaly of strangers to a statutory scheme using that scheme selectively, that statutory scheme selectively, to avoid contractual obligations. There's a very good example of that sort of overarching concern in a case this court decided, it's called Hellenic Republic. It involved a surgeon here in Chicago performing kidney transplants for the benefit of the government of Greece. The Greek government didn't like the price of the kidney transplants. They defended based on the fact the renal hospital didn't have a certificate of need. And as part of the overarching analysis, the court really weighed whether or not the benefits of enforcement outweighed the burdens. And this relatively technical violation was not deemed sufficient to defeat enforcement of a legitimate contract.
Okay. In your mind, if there was an illegal act, of course, in your mind, there was none. I understand that, of course. But if there was an illegal act, would it have been lending the full amount instead of a maximum of half for the stock purchase and not filling out the necessary paperwork?
May I answer?
Oh, please. You want me to sleep tonight?
Very much, Your Honor. I think if our overarching arguments are not accepted, and if Reg G and Reg U are applicable, we don't quarrel with their specific recitation of the ways in which Reg G and Reg U were violated. That there's no dispute, in other words, that they did loan 100% of the purchase price and that the forms were not provided. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 8 minutes out of your 10. The idea that this was not a financing agreement for Comdisco in some way is preposterous. I mean, there's $109 million that came into Comdisco in an off-balance sheet transaction. Whether you want to call it a financing agreement or some other, financial arrangement, it had that effect. With respect to the McCauley letter, Your Honor correctly pointed out that Judge Gettleman essentially said, well, but for the McCauley letter, I would have found, at a minimum, that there's a issue of fact about whether Reg G and U are violated. And
we cited in our brief the numerous examples, instances where the trustee kept representing that McCauley was a staff attorney of the Federal Reserve Board, when in fact he was a staff attorney at the Federal Reserve Bank, a private corporation. There's no dispute here that Comdisco did provide a guarantee. There's also no dispute that the bank was relying on the stock, and if you were to find that there's no dispute on that, there certainly is and should be a genuine issue of material fact with respect to that issue. I encourage the court to take a careful look at the definition of indirectly secured in the regulations, sections 221.113, E, F, and G. Also in our reply brief at page 23, we cited a federal board opinion to the effect that reliance on proceeds of the sale of securities is the same as reliance on the stock itself and brings the transaction within the concept of indirectly secured. And in this case, there's no doubt that this stock was restricted. It was labeled as restricted stock. It was held by Comdisco's transfer agent. There was a blank stock power that each borrower had to sign, and the proceeds of that stock had to be used to pay off the loan. So it's very clear that the bank was relying on the stock, and the bank did not satisfy, for summary judgment purposes, the good faith non-reliance exception in any event. Mr. Young made the point that I'm going to go on to another matter. The idea that some people may have cashed out of this before Comdisco crashed is beside the point. That's an issue that always arises in situations where you have contracts that are illegal. With respect to the NIPSCO case that Mr. Young cited, that's a good example of an issue that the trustee never raised until its reply brief on summary judgment, and all of a sudden it started introducing all of these equitable concepts into the record.
I didn't remember much of it at trial.
Well, that's my point. Number one, discovery was never closed. We never had our day in court. And that's what we're asking for here, is our day in court. Nothing more, nothing less. Mr. Young also said that if a contract is not inherently illegal, there's a presumption that it's legal. That's exactly the opposite presumption. The presumption is that it's illegal, and that's clear under the law. With respect to 29C that Mr. Young brought up, again, that was an issue that was never raised by the trustee. And when you look at Section 29C, it actually supports the argument. We go into this in our reply, why 29B can be properly raised as a defense to the enforceability of the contract. 29C has a couple of safe harbor type provisions, and it talks about extensions of credit that are outside of 29B, and there's only three statutes in the 1934 Act, Section 7C, Section 7D, and one of the provisions of Section 11, that make illegal extensions of credit. So the fact that there were certain extensions of credit that were safe harbored shows very clearly as a matter of textual analysis that a violation of Section 7D would be a matter that could be raised as a matter of by defense pursuant to Section 29B. In our papers, we show that whether under Illinois law or federal law, we have the right to raise illegality as a defense to enforcement of the contract. And I'm not going to belabor that point, but except to encourage each of you to carefully look at both Illinois law and federal law, as I'll know you do when you evaluate this matter. The bottom line is that the illegality of this transaction was at the heart of it. And they did their best to find a way to try to maneuver around the illegality of Regulation G and U, but we submit they didn't do it, and we submit that we're entitled to our day in court with respect to that issue. It would have been impossible for this transaction to go forward and for ComDisco and the bank to perform without violating the regulations. There would not have been any transaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the second case this morning, United States versus Rodriguez.
Isn't that funny?
Well, they took it.